Last night I sat on the out back with three of my friends, 30 plus year friends, and we were talking about some of the most powerful experiences in our lives, experiencing God in some of our most difficult times in our lives. And we agreed that those were almost always the exact same times. And so one of the things that came to my mind, and I won't tell the whole story because I've told it before, many of you have heard it, but it was the most powerful day of my life so far and the most miserable day of my life so far. It was Easter Sunday morning, 2009 in Iraq, and I was to deliver the outdoor sunrise service, and I stood underneath the concrete grandstands of this soccer stadium in the dark. It was early, and I put my head against the concrete pillar, and my prayer was, God, what have you done to me? And I looked at the notes I'd prepared for the message, and they looked like empty words, so I crumbled them up, threw them away. And I was discouraged, I was anxious, I was desperate, and then I had to go speak to a large group of discouraged, anxious, and hungry people. And I wasn't anxious because I was afraid of speaking. In fact, that morning, I didn't care much about anything, especially what people thought of me. So I scratched a few words on a piece of paper, and feeling like a dead man on the inside, I preached just a simple sermon on the gospel. And as I did, the Holy Spirit fell on that place. You could see it. It was an outdoor setting. In the weeks and months that followed, it was clear from the impact that God had moved. But as I spoke, I felt like I was an outsider watching this happen. And I realized this was not about me. This was about God feeding his people. And whether I felt up to it or not, the shepherd was taking care of his sheep. In this case, it was the good shepherd feeding his hungry sheep through a hungry sheep. So let's look at Mark chapter 6, starting in verse 30. If you haven't been with us this year, we're working our way through the Gospel of Mark. This is where we are this morning. The apostles gathered around Jesus and reported to him all they had done and taught. Then, because so many people were coming and going that they didn't even have a chance to eat, he said to them, come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest. So the boys are back from their mission trip, and they're excited to tell this story. They had, chapter 6, verse 12 says they had preached, and a lot of people had responded to the gospel. They had exorcised demons. They had done some physical healing. And so what do you think this reporting session would have looked like if you had been present? Sir, here's our mission report. We had 107 converts, 10 exorcisms, 30 verified physical healings. Pending further questions, this concludes my brief. Do you think that's what it looked like? I'm pretty sure it didn't. I'm pretty sure it was like, Jesus, you should have seen it. That was amazing. I mean, people were weeping and repenting, couldn't believe it. Yeah, and there was this little girl who was sick. Her dad was a skeptic. She was healed. Her dad broke down. I mean, we all were breaking down. Even Peter was crying. No, I wasn't. Yes, you were. I mean, that's what it looked like. It was cool, amazing stuff. And they were excited to tell the Lord about it. And I'm sure he was excited to hear about it. And as they're telling the stories, the crowds begin to press in on Jesus and the people. So like any good leader, he sees a need to take care of his boys. So he gets them back in the boat, which is their floating refuge. When they need time alone, they got to get in this boat. And they go across the lake to get some rest, get some food. And Jesus said, okay, boys, get in the boat. Keep talking. I'm listening. But let's go out here in the lake. So with a headwind likely, and the disciples were in no hurry to make landfall. They wanted time with Jesus. The crowds are able to get around the other side of the lake, and they're waiting for him on the shore to arrive. Now, I can imagine the disciples were pretty irritable by now. They're tired, they're hungry, they're sick of people, likely, and these people will not give them a break. And so now the excitement of ministry, seeing God move, people responding, gives way to the reality that the need doesn't end. And to the reality that this unending need exceeds their human capacity, physical, mental, and spiritual. And we've probably all felt this way, serving, helping, giving. It doesn't end. It can feel like trying to empty the ocean with a Dixie cup. How is this making any difference at all? And because that's true, some people stand on the sidelines and say, if it doesn't end, why should I even begin? And that's why we're not driven primarily by the vastness of the need, but rather the love of God manifests to us and through us. Because when we are need-driven, we will eventually become overwhelmed, possibly burned out, disillusioned. But when we're love-driven, God has loved us, we love others, our ambition becomes faithfulness. We don't focus on the need. I mean, we see the need, we glance at the need, but we look to our stewardship. It's required those who have been given a call, given a trust, be found faithful. So Youth Horizons has two homes for boys. They're building two more. You should go out and see it. It's amazing what's happening out there. Almost over $2 million have been raised, around $2 million have been raised to build these final two homes. And when it's done, they'll house around 32 boys. You tell it to some people and they go, 32? Do you know how many troubled boys there are in the nation in Kansas? You see what the need-driven mentality by itself does. It immobilizes. If Ernest had been just looking at the need alone versus his call, it's unlikely he would have built four homes. But when someone says, you know how many boys are out there? My response would be, yeah, but have you seen our boys? Have you met our boys? This is our stewardship, our opportunity. Have you seen our boys being loved and changed? Have you met them? They're worth every ounce of effort, every dollar spent. There are so many people so far from God. The need is overwhelming. So we're immobilized by the need. But love, which is always practical, not theoretical, is expressed in the concrete here and now of the person God puts in front of us to love right here, right now. This person I'm talking to right here, serving right now, this person is never some statistic in an overwhelming mass of humanity. This person is my opportunity, my stewardship, my expression of God's love to and through me. If you look at Jesus, he knew how great the need was, and he was continually moved with compassion, which is love and action, to individuals, not masses of need. Verse 34, when Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So how did the Lord see a large crowd? As individual sheep. And he was their shepherd. He would even tell a great story about a shepherd with a lot of sheep who lost one and didn't go, eh. He went and looked for the one, and then threw a party when he found the one. So that's how Jesus sees people. He began to teach them many things, and by this time it was late in the day, so his disciples came to him. This is a remote place, they said. It's already very late. Send the people away so they can go get to the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat. But he answered, you give them something to eat. They said to him, that would take 8 months' pay. Are we to go and spend that much on bread and give it to the people? So the Lord has compassion on his guys. He knows they need time to rest and time to debrief, but he's also training them that very often life doesn't let you do that. And so the good shepherd has compassion on his sheep, not just these 12 he's training to be shepherds, but on all of his sheep. And so he looks up and he sees this confused mass, scared and hungry, sheep without a shepherd, and he moves to action. Now take this narrative this week and the narrative from last week, put them together. What's wrong with the picture? Who's supposed to be the leader of these people, humanly speaking? Who has a human authority to lead in this country, in that country? Herod. What's Herod doing? He's throwing himself a party, hanging out in his palace down south, watching pretty girls dance, beheading prophets, while his people are desperate for leadership. The human leader is indulging himself, playing. So they turn to this young prophet, looking for someone to lead. That, by the way, would be an entire other message contrasting between Herod, who was the appointed leader, who's taking care of himself, and Jesus, who's the anointed leader, who's taking care of others. But we'll move on. Jesus begins to instruct them in the truth. He leads them in their thinking in the direction that their lives need to go, which is always where it starts. It starts in your thinking, moves into your life. And remember, he did a lot of miracles, but they were always to validate his message. They were signs pointing to his message. Physical healings didn't last. People were healed. They would eventually grow sick and die. And the amazing miracle he's about to perform here of feeding a lot of people was very temporary. I mean, how long does a full stomach last before it's empty and crying out for more again? But to give people the truth of the gospel, to show them the way God designed them, the kind of life they could live, that was a gift that was permanent in its results. And so when he landed, he didn't start healing and feeding. He started teaching, changing people's lives. Now, evidently, the people were aware of what was happening because they were hanging out in a remote place and the sun's going down, and they were eager to stay and listen. As this happens, the disciples are concerned that if the sun goes down, a large crowd, which is 5,000 men, Mark says, in the Greek it's men, so there's women and children. We don't know how many people there were, but more than 5,000. If they don't get started back towards some towns, they're going to be forced to go without food. And so they think the Lord's oblivious to people's needs. So they want to tell Jesus, hey, Jesus, these people are going to get hungry if you don't let them go buy some food for themselves. Now, the Lord never lacked situational awareness. He didn't say, I didn't think of that. I was so caught up in my teaching. How stupid of me. He didn't miss a beat. He said, you guys feed them. Now, for me, it's not a stretch to, well, for me, it would be a stretch to not imagine the Lord smiling when he said this. I can't conceive of these boys tired, hungry, and he looks and says, you feed them, and not smiling. I mean, I would be smiling if I said that. I imagine the disciples weren't smiling. They were probably, but I think he was smiling. Okay, you guys just told me all these cool stories, how you saw God move. You feed them. Now, I don't mean he was mocking them, but I think he was probably smiling. And when he saw the looks on their face, I'm sure he was smiling. And as I thought about this passage this week, I thought, how often do the Jesus who I hold in my mind as a picture of who he is and was, how often does he have a smile on his face? And if the Jesus you hold in your mind rarely, if ever, has a smile on his face, I'm pretty sure he doesn't match the Jesus who exists. And I'm sure when the boys were telling their great stories, he was smiling. And I'm positive that little children wouldn't flock to him if he had a no face. Now, little children and adults, by and large, are not drawn to frowns. And so Jesus spent a lot of time smiling. I'm sure he did, because he had a whole lot to smile about. You say, well, Terry had a lot to cry about too. Of course he did. But we all know that having things to cry about doesn't preclude us from having things to smile about. And so, at any rate, whether he was teasing them or not, he goes from that to astonishing them. Because when they look at him, and I'm sure he's smiling, and then they look at him again, he's not kidding. Feed him. He really means this. And so, he's going to allow his guys to take part in the process. Actually, he's going to feed them, but he's going to allow his boys to take part in the process. So, how many loaves do you guys have? Go find out. Well, there's 5 loaves and 2 fish. And so, he directed them to all sit down in groups on the green grass. They sat down in groups of hundreds and fifties. And this is, and we'll look at this in a minute, this is a whole lot like what Moses did in the wilderness when he was organizing the people. And there's going to be a lot of similarities here between this and the Exodus. Took the 5 loaves, the 2 fish, looked up to heaven, gave thanks, broke the loaves, gave them to the disciples to set before the people, and they divided the 5 fish among them all. Then they ate and were satisfied. Picked up 12 basketfuls of leftovers when it was said and done. The number of the men who had eaten was 5,000. Now, many people, because of their presuppositions, not because of a rational basis, find this story unbelievable. And so what I want to do is take a little, not diversion, but a little side application here for those who are listening who struggle with intellectual doubts about the gospel. And not to belittle you for your doubts. Your doubts are your doubts, and your struggles are your struggles, and God certainly doesn't belittle you, so neither would I, but I want to hopefully offer some help. So let's talk about this miracle. Mark says it sat on the green grass. If you've been around since we started Mark, you know Mark is not one to waste words. He's to the point. So you could say, Mark, what other color is grass? Well, it could be brown. And so he's telling us this was springtime. This was around the time of Passover, which is a part of what Mark's trying to show us here. This is all kind of a Passover type event. He's also letting us know that as Peter was telling him this story, details stood out in Peter's mind, like the grass was green. This is a historical recounting of an event. All 4 gospel writers tell the same story. It's the only miracle that all 4 tell. So it's very important. And it's very important for a couple of reasons. We'll get to one in a minute. It's because it prefigures the gospel itself, and it connects the gospel back to the Exodus. But it also is important to know all 4 tell it, showing how important it was and how widely it was distributed, because all 4 guys were telling this story, writing it down, and out of these 5,000 plus people, many of them were still alive when it was being written down and distributed. It would have been very easy for a lot of people, hundreds of people, to say, that wasn't so, I was there, that didn't happen. But historically, that didn't happen. Nobody stood up and said that. Nobody was able to suppress the story, which could have easily been suppressed by that many eyewitnesses. Why? Because it happened. There were thousands of eyewitnesses, many were still alive when this was being written down and spread, who were able to go, yeah, I was there, or I know so-and-so who was there. Because this wasn't a huge country you're talking about. Some people I've read said this was a miracle of sharing, so the boys, people get out their picnic and share, so everybody feels guilty and starts sharing their picnic baskets. So it turns into a massive potluck dinner in the wilderness. So a little irrational, 5,000 plus people who were in a hurry to get around, happened to have enough food to feed 5,000 plus people with a lot of food left over. That didn't happen. And all four writers would not have included this in their books if it was just a story of a potluck in the wilderness. They told the story because it was something much more than that. Say, Terry, what about the miracle itself? Isn't the miracle unbelievable? At this point, some of you are saying, Terry, we believe it, move on. Well, have patience with those who have real intellectual struggles, because there's a diversity of people here and people listen to podcasts, and so some people are helped by this conversation. If you believe it and are ready to move on, praise God for giving you the faith, but have compassion on those who need and want a little bit more. So let me give you an analogy that helps me think about this. What if you landed on Earth from another planet? On your planet, since history had begun, since anybody could remember, bread appeared in the front of people's houses each morning, always had. And scientists on your planet, it happened since beginning of time as far as you knew. So scientists had come up with a way to describe this process in scientific terms. They could tell you what happened in the molecules, how they came together and make bread appear. It was all a very natural process. Now, if we went to their planet, we would think it was a supernatural process. But in their planet, very natural. So he comes to our planet, and where's the bread? And your system is broken. Say, well, bread doesn't appear in the morning. Well, how do you guys get bread? Well, we take this piece of grain here, and we go stick it in the dirt. Then we stand around and wait for water to fall from the sky. And then we wait for photons to transmit energy into the seeds, and then the seed dies. And then after it dies, it produces this stalk with a ton of wheat on it. Then we collect it, crush it, cook it, and make bread and pies. And for all you gluten-free friends, substitute rice or some other food you find delicious. Same principle. And so you, our friend from another planet, look at this and say, this is supernatural. This is a miracle. This is amazing. A seed, dirt, water falls from the sky, photons bouncing off of it turns it into bread. My point is that what we call natural is merely what's normal for us. What else could it be if it happened on a regular basis? But what's natural remains amazing. And just because scientists have assigned names to products and processes doesn't mean they figured out what it is, why it is. We think of that naming things is the same as explaining things. What's normal, what we call natural, is what happens most of the time, but there's no rational reason to believe that the normal could not be superseded in a miracle. Jesus, who made the physical world, Jesus, who designed the physical processes, simply altered those processes in this instance to communicate something important. It's not unbelievable at all that God in human form could make bread and fish in an instant rather than taking the time of the normal processes. But the point of this story is not about the bread and the fish. I heard this story in Sunday school as a kid, and I probably drew a little picture. It was probably horrible because I was horrible at drawing. Still, I'm horrible at drawing. But I remember these kinds of stories, and Jesus, and it all felt to me like, in retrospect, Jesus was sort of doing magical stuff. And I vaguely remember thinking Jesus is special, but I didn't really connect the event with really what the point of the event was. I had no real sense of Jesus being practical in my life. It was a cool story, but I was not particularly impacted by it. I mean, my mom could feed a lot of people. I was amazed by that. She could take a few bags from Dillon's and feed a whole bunch of people, turn it into a meal. But the reality was not the meal. The purpose of telling the story was not the meal. That was never the purpose. Mark's point in telling the story and the very words he uses are to help us see something bigger than this massive potluck dinner in the wilderness. If you think about it, these people were not really in desperate straits. They could have walked to some nearby villages and gotten food. Besides, if you miss a meal or two, you won't die. So they're not in dangerous situation. So there's obviously much more here than meeting the very temporary needs of some hungry stomachs. This is acting out the gospel. This is the Exodus to the cross. This is Jesus pulling together all of what God has done in history and saying, I'm the fulfillment. It paints a picture of the gospel. Exodus was the most important event in Israel's history. It was their defining moment where God took them out of hundreds of years of captivity, brought them through the wilderness, provided for them miraculously, turned them into his people, gave them the promised land. It was a defining event. And the New Testament is full of connections between the Exodus and the gospel. Jesus shows up over and over in those connections. He's the Passover lamb. He's called the Passover lamb. They spread the blood of the lamb over the door so that God's judgment would not fall on that house. He's the good shepherd who exceeds the great shepherd Moses. He's the life-giving bread provided for them in the wilderness. On and on and on. This is not just historical revisionism. This is what the entire Old Testament Exodus unfolding over centuries pointed forward to. And when Moses was about to die and was not going to be able to enter the promised land because of his rebellion, he asked the Lord this. He said, "Would you appoint a leader to go out and come in before the people so that the Lord's people will not be like sheep without a shepherd?" Sound familiar? In the short run, God gave a replacement for Moses. It was Joshua who became the warrior leader. Moses was a shepherd leader. Joshua was a warrior leader. But it was pointing forward to Jesus, who is the shepherd leader at his first advent, who will return as what? The warrior leader. Look at a single New Testament passage that makes this connection between the Exodus and Jesus in multiple ways. Now, when I read this, I'll tell you right up front, it's confusing. So I'll read it, and then we'll look at the bottom line. "I don't want you to be ignorant of the fact, brothers, that our forefathers were all under the cloud, and they all passed through the sea. They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They ate the same spiritual food, drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them, and that rock was Jesus." So here's what Paul's saying. Israel experienced God's presence in the wilderness, in the Exodus, leading them under the pillar. Remember the pillars that guided them at night and by day? That was God's presence with them. They experienced God's protection taking them through the sea. And they experienced God's provision providing food when there wasn't any and water when there wasn't any. And baptized is a little confusing, but in the Greek it would have been immersed in Moses, and so it's translated into baptized. But basically what it means is they were immersed in Moses' leadership, completely immersed in his leadership, and Moses was God's anointed leader. And so when they immersed themselves in his leadership, they were uniting themselves with God. That's what that means. They were following God's anointed leader, which means they were joining God himself. And so Moses prefigured Jesus, who would open up a way to lasting life in God. So the New Testament says that we've been baptized into Christ Jesus. Following God's anointed one, we have a relationship with God. The spiritual food and drink thing, what is that about? Well, it was real food, it was real drink. It wasn't invisible food, it was real food and real drink, but it was miraculously provided. It came out of nowhere, like our guests from another planet. It just showed up, it was manna. And the water came out of a rock. So it was them experiencing the grace of God. It was grace food, real food, but it was grace food because it was something they needed, but they could not provide for themselves. That pointed forward to Jesus. Look at John 6:30. They ask him, "Jesus, what miraculous sign will you give us so that we may see it and believe you? What will you do? Our forefathers ate the manna, this bread in the desert. As it is written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat." And Jesus said, "I tell you the truth, it wasn't Moses who's giving you the bread from heaven, but my Father who gives you the true bread from heaven." He's connecting the Exodus, their great important event, with himself. "For the bread of God is he who comes from heaven and gives life to the world. Sir, give us this bread. I am the bread of life. If you come to me, you'll never go hungry. You believe in me, you'll never go thirsty." You see the connection he's making here? All of what God had been doing in history was leading up to Jesus. The captivity and the Exodus was a centuries-long preview of the coming attraction that was Jesus. And then in Hebrews, you see Jesus being the new and improved Moses. Hebrews 3:1. "Brothers who share in this heavenly calling, fix your thoughts on Jesus, the apostle and high priest, we confess. He was faithful to the one who appointed him, just as Moses was faithful in all God's house. Jesus has been found worthy of greater honor than Moses, just as the builder of a house has greater honor than the house itself." So Moses, who was the Israelites' hero of heroes, he was the house of faith, but Jesus is the builder of the house of faith. And the builder always exceeds the building in greatness. So look at the Exodus pictures here. I'll give you just a few of them. You have a wicked and murderous leader who's supposed to be leading, who's just killing and taking care of himself, Herod. You have the people in the desert, in the wilderness, led by a good shepherd, who even brings organization just like Moses did back in the Exodus. He provides food for them miraculously. And he is God's presence, his protection, and his provision. And then Mark almost shouts the connection between what the Lord is doing here in feeding this mass of people and what he's going to do on the cross. So right here, the reason why all four gospel writers included is because it connects all of Israel's history with Jesus, what he's doing now, and what he's going to do on the cross. In verse 41, he took the five loaves and the two fish. He looked up to heaven. He gave thanks. He He broke the loaves, gave to the people who ate and were satisfied. Does that sound familiar? Sounds like 1 Corinthians 11:23, the Lord Jesus on the night he was betrayed took bread. When he'd given thanks, he broke it. This is my body which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me. The reason why we have this story of this mass feeding in the wilderness, and they were going to be hungry again by the next morning, is because it was all painting this massive living sermon of God's work through the ages, pointing to the gospel. You say, this is all very fascinating, Terry, but where's the application? One application is that, like Rodney said, we see God as being great and out there, but sometimes is he that involved in my life, and what does that mean practically? And we tend to see God as being wise and mighty, but not all that smart. If he's not that smart, he doesn't necessarily know what he's doing. And he knows how to run the universe, but he doesn't know how to run my life. And I'm telling you, when you look at how, this is not just, again, revisionism, when you look at how God has tied human history together, how can you not be impressed with just how brilliant he is? And if he's brilliant, he knows what he's doing. That's one application. Another is in the statement, you feed him. Remember when Jesus said this, the disciples were tired, and Mark said they were hungry. So here are these hungry, hurting, lost people. The need is overwhelming, and the Lord looks at these hungry, hurting, tired disciples and said, you feed them. That's the context. And in so doing, they're going to experience God. So let me tell you what I'm not saying. The application is not, okay, you need to go give money to more programs and ministries to take care of people's needs, or go give more money to homeless people. You can. That's a valid thing to do. I read an article by an expert on homeless people, and he said the first three rules of working with homeless people are don't give money, when in doubt, refer to 1 and 2, don't give money. But then he went on to say, give your life. If you really want to help them, give your life. So give money away to ministries to help people, but the application of you feed them means to join people in what he's doing, join God in what he's doing to care for people in your context. He's going to do what only he can do, but he invites us to join him. He really does invite us to be his conduit. But this is going to most often mean living beyond yourself. So when me and my friends were talking last night about our greatest experience with God, we started scratching our heads because it was always in the context, almost always, of some of our most difficult times. So we can't look at our own lives, our own capacity, our own feelings of adequacy or inadequacy, how much energy we think we have, how much ability we think we have, and conclude, I can't feed them, I've got nothing. Because we're going to see God move in power most often in situations that are beyond our own resources. I can't tell you how many times I've seen this true. But I also can tell you it's really easy to say on a Sunday morning, and it can be terrifying to live it out. And you say, well, Terry, I don't want to live in a terrifying. I don't want to live at the end of myself. We're going to. We're going to consistently live at the end of ourselves, but why waste that? Why not live at the end of ourselves and there experience God? Because we spend our lives trying to hold back from getting to the end of ourselves. Do you think that'll keep it from happening? Of course not. But if we'll wrestle with God and wrestle with our own hearts and minds and say, God, I trust you. You're really smart. I'm scared to death. I'm worn out. I'm hungry. I'm empty, but here I am. You feed them. Jesus is actually saying, I'm going to feed them, but I'm going to let you participate. So when I read this, the thing I've asked myself all week is, Terry, what do you want? What do you want? Do I want a life that fits neatly within the bounds of my own capacity, fixed by the facts of my feelings, of my own resources, and then die? And I'm going to go to heaven. I'm confident of that. Or do I want to join God in what he's doing? Do I want to live in a place that's beyond my own, not just my own perceived capacities, but my own real capacities? A life that experiences God in his power. I think it's a dumb application to go feel guilty about this, personally. I mean, you're welcome to do that, but I just can't see how that's helpful. I think a great application is just be honest with God. Because I think pretty much most of us want to see God move. Pretty much most of us don't want to get to the end of ourselves. And so just be honest with God. You know, I want to see you move in ways that are unexplainable. I also don't want to get to the end of myself. I also know that doesn't work that way. So figure out what it means. Ask God to help you figure out what it means to be hungry, tired, with limited resources, and then God says, feed them. Feed them. What people most need is to see the good news lived and hear the good news spoken. That's what they most need. Let's pray together. Talk to God about your life. You make the application. Ask Him to help you make the application. And it is okay to be confused or scared. It's okay. It's actually quite normal. And those are the kind of places God will meet you as well.